morning, counsel. We will get the bailiff a second to get back into the courtroom. You may be seated. And please keep your masks on while you are not arguing, but when you are arguing, we would appreciate it if you take your mask off so that we can hear and understand what you have to say.
Thank you.
This is State versus Amdara. I will point out to you, two members of the court are participating by WebEx. WebEx, that is Justice Miller Lerman and Justice Funk on the bench. I'm Mike Hevigan, the Chief Justice. Justices Castle, Stacey, Papik, and Friedenberg are all here in the courtroom. Do either counsel have any questions before we begin? Thank you very much. Ms. Lucas, then, good morning to you. You may approach and may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, I am April Lucas, Douglas County Assistant Public Defender, appearing on behalf of Ms. Brandy Andera, the appellant in this matter. My request today is that this matter, decision of the district, reverse the district's Andera's motion to suppress evidence based on the fact that one, the district court's finding of fact were clearly erroneous, and two, the facts in this case do not fit the applicable standards of law that have been upheld in Nebraska courts.
Counsel, with respect to your first point, I'm a little surprised because I did not read your brief to attack the district court's findings of historical fact. Did I miss something?
No, Your Honor. Unfortunately, it was briefed separately by a different attorney that is no longer in our office. But I believe within the arguments in our brief would be inherent that the court's finding of fact were erroneous, as well as that the court just did not apply the facts to the case correctly.
You're not contesting the validity of the traffic stop.
That's correct.
And you're not contesting the factual finding that the search was undertaken pursuant the consent of the female driver?
No, I'm not. Just that consent was not a valid third party consent to search another person's property.
And that's really the legal issue, isn't it? Not a matter of historical fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'm still puzzled by what finding of historical fact of the district court you're taking issue with, even at argument today.
Your Honor, then let me clarify that even if you take the district court's finding of fact, not as clearly, you just take it as it is, I still submit to this court that the district court's finding of fact did not meet the applicable standards of law to justify a third party consent search in this case. And the fact—
What finding of fact are you talking about?
I am referring to the district court's finding of fact that the officers had a reasonable belief that the purse in this case, that the driver would have had common authority or mutual use over the purse to grant consent to search that. I believe in the Bill of Exceptions on page 38, consent to search that. I believe the district court's finding says, Officer Strudel would have, and this is on line 15, I apologize. Officer Strudel would have been, and then paused, had the legal right to search containers, I guess, found therein, including the purse. My issue there is that the district court seems to say that the search could have extended to all containers and also this purse. Even if you find that the district court was not clearly erroneous in determining what I took as him saying that it, the officers could have searched all containers, but specifically this purse, I still believe that there are not facts sufficient here to justify the standards of law that are required for a third-party consent search. And specifically that is the only finding of fact that I see that the district court has made. And in reality, the only facts in this case as I see them are that there was a valid traffic stop. There were three parties in this vehicle. There was a female driver and a female passenger and a male driver's side passenger. There's the only facts that I can glean from the
purse was found on the floor of the right front seat.
By the passenger, yes, on the passenger floorboard.
For purposes of this analysis, we can ignore the back seat passenger.
The only relevant point I'd like to make about him is that he had no relationship there was no fact indicating that he had a relationship with the passenger driver, because I do believe that they ended up arresting him for some false information or having a warrant. So just to separate that he, just based on this, the facts that were presented, that he had no relationship with the passenger.
You would agree that the trial court at the conclusion of the suppression hearing made three statements that might be interpreted as either findings of fact or perhaps in the case of the middle one, a conclusion of law, right?
I guess I'm not sure what
three. There were three. Essentially said the trial judge said three things during the course of that discussion at the end of the hearing, right?
Are you asking me what those three things are?
No, I want to be sure we're on the same page. We're talking about three.
Yes, I could count at least three things that the district.
As to the middle one, when one reads that carefully, does one find at least the inference that there was a credibility finding by the trial judge that the officer's testimony was correct?
I do believe that that the judge found the officer's testimony credible. With that being said, I don't believe the officer's testimony would reach to the level of an objective, reasonable standard to believe that there was common authority or.
So now we're into the realm of the legal part, right?
Yes.
Okay. So it's really not as. An argument of historic fact, it's an argument of law.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
So, and the facts as presented in this case do not support that the driver had any sort of common use or authority over the purse located in the passenger seat of Ms. Andera. First and foremost, the facts established that the driver was outside of the vehicle at the time officer asked for consent to search the vehicle. So it's conceded that Ms. Andera was inside the vehicle at the time the consent was asked to search the car. Furthermore, this was not the officer's consent and given. There's nothing to indicate that there was a limit on the consent or that there were specific items discussed regarding consent. So Ms. Andera there's no evidence that Ms. Andera even knew that a search was happening, because when consent was asked for regarding a search, she was in the passenger seat.
I don't understand the state to be taking the position that Ms. Andera consented to the search. I understand it to be an argument based on the officer's an objective, reasonable understanding that a reasonable officer would have under the circumstances, which, when you boil them down, don't they boil down to you've got two women in the front seat and one purse?
Yes, Your Honor. Just noting that fact that by her silence, she was not consenting to the search. There are several cases that talk about silence when a search is being conducted, that the person is then consenting to that search. So I'm just trying to make clear that by her silence, there's no evidence that she even knew a search was taking place. But with regard to your point that the facts are that there are two females in one purse, and the officer's testimony that, one, she did not know whose purse it was. She testified that it could have been the driver's purse or the passenger's purse. She also testified that she had no indication that the driver had common authority or use over this purse. Her subjective belief that she believed the purse to be linked to the purse is really irrelevant, because this is an objective standard of reasonableness. So her subjective belief was, in my opinion, has no play in the facts here.
When Ms. Andera got out of the vehicle and didn't take the purse with her, what would that suggest to a reasonable officer?
Well, the problem with that, Your Honor, is that we don't know if Ms. Andera was instructed to leave the purse or not. So I guess it would depend on that fact that the state did not present, that the state should have asked whether Ms. Andera was required or was asked to leave the purse in the vehicle, or whether Ms. Andera chose to leave it in the vehicle. But as a reasonable, objective outsider, knowing how this works, I would argue that most oftentimes law enforcement prefers that you leave your objects in the car when they ask you to get out of a vehicle.
Did the appellant ask if she should leave the purse in there?
No, but
did she testify that she was told to leave the purse in there?
She did not. However, I'd submit that it's the state's burden to show that this per se unlawful search was valid, and that they failed to do so by not asking those questions.
Was the purse searched inside the vehicle, or did the officers take it outside the vehicle and do the search on the hood?
I'm out of time, Your Honor. May I answer that question?
You may.
Thank you. From the Bill of Exceptions that I understood, the purse was searched inside the vehicle, as far as I can tell. I don't believe that there was any evidence otherwise that it was searched outside in front of her. From my understanding, it was searched inside of the vehicle.
So she would have never had the opportunity to claim ownership of it?
Correct.
Okay.
With that, Your Honors, we ask that you please reverse and remand this case with instructions to grant the motion to suppress. Thank you.
Okay.
Motion to suppress. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Osborne, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General, representing the appellee, the state of Nebraska in this case. This is a criminal case where the appellant was convicted after a stipulated bench trial of possession of methamphetamine. Appellant argues the district court should have granted her motion to suppress because she claims her purse was subjected to an illegal search and seizure. The state disagrees. As conceded in the previous argument, the initial stop of the vehicle was valid. Appellant is not arguing otherwise, so that's really not an issue on appeal. The state agrees that appellant had a reasonable expectation of privacy in what was later determined to be her purse, which was found inside the vehicle during the consent search. And even though she did not have standing to challenge the search of the vehicle itself. So this case, the actual issue deals with third-party consent and apparent authority. We know consent to search is a well-established exception to the warrant requirement. It's also well-established that a third party has apparent authority to consent to a search if an officer could have reasonably believed the third party had authority over the area searched. Apparent authority is determined on an objective standard, so it doesn't matter what the actual officer believed, but what a reasonable officer would have believed based on the information known to the officer at the time. The standard here is not whether the factual determination was ultimately correct, but whether it was reasonable.
Remind me of the facts when the driver got out of the car? Did she have a purse with her?
She did not get out of the car with the purse. The purse was left inside the vehicle when she got out of the vehicle.
I'm working on the assumption, perhaps incorrectly, but I'm working on the assumption there's two ladies in the front seat the driver has a purse? Did the driver take her purse with her when she got out of the car?
There's only one purse in the car and two females in the front, in both of the front seats, a driver and the front passenger seat.
I beg your pardon. So the driver doesn't possess a purse. Is that what the record shows?
Ultimately, the record shows that the driver apparently didn't have a purse because the purse found in the vehicle was determined to be the front seat passengers. There's only one purse in the vehicle at the time of the search, and both of the females got out of the vehicle, and the purse was left inside on the front passenger floorboard. Appellant agrees that if it was reasonable for an officer to believe the purse belonged to the driver, that the search was proper. She just disagrees that it was a reasonable belief. And there's two reasons provided in the brief as to why. First, the purse was located on the front passenger floorboard. And second, all females have their own purse. That second issue, the fact that females generally do not share purses, that's really an issue of common authority over an item, and that's not really involved in this case. We're talking about apparent authority here. So as for the location of the purse in the vehicle, the state disagrees that this makes it unreasonable for an officer to believe that the purse belonged to the driver, who's the person who consented to the search of the vehicle, because it ignores the fact that no other purse was found in the vehicle. The driver was also female and not male. And it is common for female drivers to place their purse on the passenger seat or the front passenger floorboard while they're driving. In determining whether any officer's belief of apparent authority is objectively reasonable, one inquiry is, when is there a duty to inquire? Appellant suggests in her argument that the presence of more than one occupant in the vehicle creates this duty to inquire because it creates a situation where the officer does not know to whom each item belongs. The state disagrees. In order to trigger a duty to inquire, the officer must be put on notice of some specific fact, must be advised in some way that the individual who granted consent to search the vehicle does not have authority over the item ultimately searched. And absent some specific fact, as opposed to some hypothetical speculation, indicating to the officer that this item may belong to the passenger or to somebody who did not consent, the officer is not required to inquire. And this is supported by the case law, because if an officer had to inquire about the ownership of personal property items within a vehicle before searching them, whenever there's multiple occupants in a vehicle, that would eliminate the need for the doctrine of apparent authority, because what you're doing is you're saying, whose is this? Whose is this? Whose is this? And you're getting consent from the people who own those items. That's actual authority. And if the standard is just that we have to have actual authority, there's no reason to even have the doctrine of apparent authority. All of the cases where you have backpacks, suitcases, tote bags, gym bags, purses, luggage, where those items have been searched without inquiry into ownership when there were multiple occupants in a vehicle, could not have a vehicle arrived at that conclusion if the rule, the duty to inquire suggested by appellant is the appropriate application here.
What is your understanding of when the duty to inquire further is triggered?
Well, when there's something suggesting to the officer that the person who did not consent has some kind of property interest or ownership of that item. In a second here, but Illinois versus Rodriguez, the Supreme Court stated that sufficient probability, not certainty, is the touchstone of reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment. So appellant suggested duty to inquire rule, that demands certainty, which is not what's required under the Fourth Amendment. So then looking at some of these cases, we have State versus Barber, an 11th Circuit case, very similar facts. And in that case, the 11th Circuit found it was reasonable for an officer to believe that the driver had apparent authority over a bag. The bag was located in that case on the front passenger floorboard, the same location involved in this case. And that his consent to search the vehicle extended to that bag. The court noted the bag's placement was within easy reach of the driver. It's the same placement we have in this case, coupled with the passenger's silence during the search that the bag belonged to him. Again, appellant in this case did not tell the officer that the bag belonged to her, nor did the driver disclaim ownership of the bag. And the third reason is that sometimes drivers use the passenger side floorboard to store their belongings. That's true in this case as well. If appellant's rule to inquire were applied, then the 11th Circuit could not have come to the conclusion that it came to, because the presence of multiple occupants in the vehicle would have given rise to this duty to inquire which items belong to who. And that's not what happened in Barber, nor is it how various other courts across the country have generally interpreted the issue.
What was found here was methamphetamine, or some kind of drug, is that correct?
Methamphetamine, yes.
And how does that figure into the test here? If you're a passenger, would you not want to speak up and say, that's my purse, if you knew there was contraband in the purse? How does that figure into?
Well, I don't know that the methamphetamine in and of itself figures into the analysis of what was reasonable in terms of what the officer, what a reasonable officer would believe. At the time of the search, the officer didn't know that there was any contraband in the purse. So,
but the passenger does know. So is the passenger, for example, making a calculated judgment to not claim the purse at the scene? Wait till later in the legal proceedings? Say it was my purse?
Well, I guess we don't know why she didn't tell the officer why the purse wasn't hers. Nobody in the vehicle disclaimed ownership and nobody claimed ownership. So based on what the officer knew at the time, there isn't any indication to the officer that the purse does not belong to the driver, who's a female, is sitting in close reach of the purse. The purse is in sitting on the front passenger floorboard where a purse would typically be sitting, especially when you have someone occupying the seat. You're not going to put the your purse on the seat when you have passengers sitting in the seat. So the location of the purse and all of the information known to the officer at the time didn't suggest, didn't indicate to the officer that anybody or that the driver did not have possessory interest in that purse.
With respect to the with respect to the location, right? The cases are the leading cases, right? In the bus, a bag is on the rack above the passengers in the bus. What has the U.S. Supreme Court said about placement and location?
I guess in terms of a case where you have luggage inside of a bus, I guess I don't know the answer to that question in terms of what about the location specifically. The passenger has a privacy interest in the bag. But the location, I guess I don't know the answer to your question.
Thank you.
So my question is one of purse etiquette. Was there testimony in this case about what women typically do with their, or men for that matter? We're in 2020. I see man purses on the internet and sometimes on the sidewalk. Was there testimony about where people typically keep their purse, or what the officer thought about where people keep their purse, or are we putting all those assumptions on it when we do the objectively reasonable officer analysis?
I don't recall that there was specific testimony about from the officer in this case happened to be a female. And I don't know that. I think she testified that purses generally are possessed by one person, that they're not generally shared by multiple people. But I don't know that she testified specifically as to, I think she may have testified that it was common for female drivers to put their purse on the passenger seat. And I guess being a female, my life experience would be that, especially when you have somebody sitting in that seat, it's also common to place your purse on the front passenger floorboard, which is also the same finding that was in Barber. And that involved two men in a bag. So it really is sort of gender neutral in the sense that we have two females in a purse. That really is no difference between two men and a backpack or some other type of bag.
That was going to be my next question. If we were talking about a gym bag instead of a purse, would this fussing have occurred?
It wouldn't. The analysis would be the exact same. You have two females in a purse, two men in a gym bag, or a man and a woman in a gym bag, or two women in a gym bag. The analysis doesn't.
Or a lunch sack down right on the passenger floorboard.
The analysis would not change in that situation. Any type of item that would be just a personal property item, suitcases, luggage, gym bags, backpacks, tote bags, purses, any of these would essentially have the same analysis. The only time when it's really different in the gender analysis is when you have a situation like Caniglia, which is a Nebraska appellate court case, where you had a male driver consenting, a female passenger, and the item being searched was a makeup purse. It's not reasonable that the male had some kind of possessory interest in that makeup purse, since it's sort of a gender identified item. But we're sort of outside of that context here. That doesn't apply.
Thank you.
I see I'm out of time, so may I just briefly finish?
Yes, you may wrap up.
So here, the officer was not made aware of anything that suggested the purse did not belong to the driver. All of the facts known to the officer at the time of the search made it objectively reasonable for an officer to believe that the driver had apparent authority over the purse. The district court did not err in denying the motion to suppress. So unless there are further questions, I would ask this court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have any time for rebuttal? There is no time for rebuttal. Thank you, counsel, for participating today. Please, when you leave the courtroom, use the side door and continue to social distance and wear your masks and do all of those wise kinds of things. Thank you very much. The next case of the day then will be State versus Collins. In that case, we'll be here in the court. Thank you.